learning how our own body, speech, and mind function, so that we can steer them in a direction that will lead to happiness for ourselves and others, particularly the happiness that does not depend on external things, but the happiness that comes from the liberated mind, from the purified mind. So in our ordinary way of looking at things, we always think happiness and suffering come from outside of us. You know, and our mind is so just kind of geared to sense objects. You know, we want beautiful things to see and to hear and to smell and taste and touch. And so we're always thinking, you know, happiness is out there and we've got to get it, you know, or I won't have it. And similarly to suffering, it's all out there. Okay. And so when we're hearing this part, you know, when we were going through the other day about different things that the master Gotama does not engage in, that other ascetics and Brahmins do engage in, you'll notice that, you know, you could listen to it in one way and say, well, what's wrong with playing hopscotch, you know, for goodness sakes? You know, what's wrong with singing, dancing, playing music, for goodness sakes? Why are all these things? It's just a whole bunch of rules of don'ts. Don't do this, don't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it sounds like it's so restrictive and so boring and so down on having a joyous life. Can't even sing happy birthday anymore. You know? And so, you know, the mind could look at it like that, like that. I mean, I've known people who have done that. But if we understand how addicted our mind is to sense objects and how we just glom on to any, you know, thing that we seem to see, hear, touch, taste, or smell, and then examine the effects that that has on our life, how we go up and down like yo-yos, don't we? Don't we? Lama Yeshe used to use that expression, the yo-yo mind. I think somebody, when he came to America, somebody got him a yo-yo. I haven't seen yo-yos in years. I don't know. Do kids still use yo-yo? Do kids? Yeah? You're our representative? No? No yo-yos? Well, I grew up with the dinosaurs. They use yo-yos. I could never get them to work properly. But I did see that yo-yos went up and down and up and down and up and down. And so when Mama used that expression, I watched, yes, my mind also. It's like a yo-yo. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down according to whatever I contact on the outside. Yeah. So there's something pleasant, up, something unpleasant, down. Something pleasant, up, something unpleasant, down. I talk to this person, I'm up. I talk to that person, I'm down. I eat this food, I'm up. I eat that food, I'm down. You know, it's like constant, like this. You know, the mind just being no stability, just constantly reactive. That's what it is. It's like reactive, you know. Anything, like, you know, how they do with the rats, you know, you just stimulate different things in the rat, you know? They're kind of like what we were, you know, put this in front of me and I jump this way and put that in front of me and I jump that way. That's kind of the way the mind was like, you know? So all these things when the Buddha is saying, you know, don't avoid these different things, or, you know, the ascetic Gotama avoids these things. It's not so that we have a very boring, dry, uninteresting life. But it's a way of clearing the sense field, okay? So that we don't get so addicted and so reactive to the sense field, because we don't have quite so much going on in it. And also so that we stop looking for happiness from outside and we begin to see that real happiness comes from in here. Yeah. Because there's a difference, isn't there, between getting happiness from hopscotch and happiness from having a peaceful, kind mind. You know? And not just because you happen to stumble into the mental state of today I feel peaceful and kind, but because you've been able to generate it and create those causes so that you can, you know, stay in that state. Okay, so there's a difference between those two kinds of happinesses. And in order to have enough space and time and ability to really train the mind so that we can develop the peace that comes from a purified mind, then in terms of time, we have to not spend so much time playing hopscotch and listening to the Rolling Stones. I'm dated, I know. Who do I use nowadays?
Oh, no, my 19-year-old listens to the Rolling Stones.
Oh,
yeah. Led Zeppelin and classic rock is very much back.
Oh, it is? Yeah. Oh, it is. Oh, okay.
You're current.
I'm current. Boy, whoever would have thought. Yeah. But just, you know, so that we don't, so we keep some quiet in our environment so that we can train our mind also to be quiet. And so that we aren't so busy seeking pleasure from outside that we forget that real happiness comes from inside. One person I know used the expression struggling for pleasure. You know? And that always, it really hit me. It really made an impact on me. You know, how much time I spend struggling for pleasure instead of just letting things be. And when I can let things be and appreciate what is, then there's no struggle and there's just a lot more peace. Yeah. But whenever my mind is saying pleasure's outside, then I struggle for it and I can never get as much as I want. Never. I always want more and better, and I never get it. Can you imagine? Unfair life. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? Okay. So, we're going on to another section. It's called the large section of morality. So, some very interesting things come up here. Okay, whereas so these are all things that people do on the outside that the Buddha is calling into question and saying, you know, why are you doing them? Are they good things to be doing? And especially with some of them, it's not that these things are not good things to do, but doing them for money is what the Buddha is calling attention to. Okay. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmins, feeding on the food of the faithful, make their living by such base arts, such as wrong means of livelihood as palmistry, divining by signs, portents, dreams, body marks, mouse gnawings, fire oblations, oblations from a ladle of husks, rice powder, rice grains, ghee or oil, from the mouth or of blood, reading the fingertips, house and garden lore, skill in charms, ghost lore, earth house lore, snake lore, poison lore, rat lore, that bird lore, crowd lore, foretelling a person's lifespan, charms against arrows, knowledge of animals' cries. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. Somebody's going to go, well, wait a minute. What's this thing about divination? Tibetans do a lot of divination. Yeah? What's this thing about crow lore? You know, they also have this thing about telling things about the from the sound of the crows. Yeah, so what about this? Why is all this stuff in here? Okay. My understanding is that a lot of the stuff, the divinations and different things that we see in Tibetan Buddhism like that, it actually predates Tibetan Buddhism. It predates the arrival of Buddhism in Tibet. And a lot of it is Tibetan cultural things. You know, so how sometimes they do fortune telling by, you know, how you grab your mala and go like this, and the dice and the dough balls and the things like that. And even if you go to Tibet, they're building different, how do you spell that, say that word, Karin? Karens? Karens. K-A-I-R-E-N. Karens.
K-A-I-R-E-N.
There's no R.
A-I-R-E-N.
N. Okay. Karen. Karen's. Okay.
Like my name.
Thank you. With an S. Okay. So, you know, they have lots of those. And even in Tibetan culture, you know, like according to, they tie all sorts of things with, like, the spirits in the area where you're born and stuff like that. And like I was saying yesterday, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they don't always differentiate what's Buddhism and what's culture. And when Buddhism arrived in Tibet, there were certain things, like I think a lot of these divination practices, that then they gave a Buddhist meaning to them, okay? And they started doing those things, but in terms of Buddhist deities, or they, yeah, developed all sorts of Buddhist meanings for these things. But the customs themselves actually came from the Bon religion that started before. I think despite, you know, the Buddha here saying don't do these things, every Buddhist culture that you look in has some kind of fortune telling. Actually, every culture we look in, Buddhist or not, has some kind of fortune telling, doesn't it? I mean, our own culture, which is supposedly so scientific, I mean, there's all sorts of fortune telling that goes on. Okay, so people have this kind of, they like it, you know, and it appeals to them. But what the Buddha is saying is, don't get lost in all of that, because, you know, that's not going to liberate you from samsara. Yeah, and that all that fortune telling isn't reliable. And even with the thing of making mows, you have to be a very competent meditator in order to do the mows properly. Yeah, because you have to be aware of all sorts of things about the person. And it is actually in our monastic vows not to do, you know, divination and stuff like that. I think why it happens in many of the cultures, the Buddhist cultures, is because it was there, it predates Buddhism. And then especially in the Mahayana countries, people see some benefit in it. And so clearly, you know, people see benefit in Mohs, so they do it, and they see benefits in making offerings to these different gods, and they do it. Now, how much is actually the mental state, and how much is actually going on outside? That, you know, the jury's out on. I remember His Holiness one time saying, you know, because the Tibetans do all these protector practices of Buddhist and worldly deities, both. And he was saying, you have all your valuable things in the altar, and then the protectors on top, and you're praying to the protectors to protect all your wealth and the, you know, that you store under the altar. And he says, that's not the way to practice Buddhism. You know, I mean, that's just looking at things for worldly gain. Yeah. So I think sometimes it's possible that these kinds of things can go overboard. I mean, even in Thailand, where people tend to keep the Vinaya very strictly, everybody gives out charms, you know, in the monasteries. They give out charms, and there's a four-faced Brahma god outside of the monasteries that people often make offerings to. And they'll do things to pacify ghosts and spirits. The monks will do things to pacify ghosts and spirits and stuff like that. So it's just, you know, it's kind of prevalent. So, think about it what you will. I mean, personally speaking, I think unless I can be sure that that kind of stuff brings a lot of benefit to other people, I'm better off using my time studying and practicing. Okay? And also, because if you do that kind of thing, what happens if the fortune you tell is wrong? Yeah. And people may wonder, it came up the other day about how in our monastic vows, we don't perform marriages or do matchmaking of any sort. And people could go, well, why not, you know? And I remember Venerable Wuyin, when she was teaching that, she was saying, well, if you do that and a couple gets together and it doesn't work out, they're going to blame you. Yeah. So she said, as a monastic, stay out of it, because it's, you know, and also it's not good for your practice, because then you see them like that and you start thinking, oh, maybe I should, you know. Okay, so the similar, I think, with palmistry and all this kind of stuff, too. You could spend a whole lot of time on that and make quite a good living, but never really transform your mind. And if the predictions you make are incorrect, then people are going to blame you, and you get in a lot of trouble. Okay. Whereas some ascetics and brahmas make their living by such base arts as judging the marks of gems, sticks, clothes, swords, spears, arrows, weapons, women, men, boys, girls, male and female slaves, elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, cows, goats, rams, cocks, quail, iguanas, and bamboo rats, tortoises, deer, the ascetic Gotama refrains from such base arts. Okay, so making their living by judging all these kind of marks. Okay, so he's saying that's kind of wrong livelihood, to spend your time judging these marks. Okay, whereas some ascetics and brahmas make their living by such base arts as predicting the chiefs will march out, the chiefs will march back. In other words, you know, there's going to be a war over here, or they're retreating, or, you know, giving prognosis on war. Did you know that Adolf Hitler tried to contact the Tibetans? Yeah, to get them to make these kind of, to do pujas for the success of his things and do predictions and stuff.
And so he got the swastika too.
Well, oh, how Hitler got the swastika. Mm-hmm. Oh, that might be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, yuck. Okay, the chiefs will march out, the chiefs will march back, our chiefs will advance, and other chiefs will retreat. Okay, our chiefs will win, and the other chiefs will lose. Other chiefs will win, and our chiefs will lose. There will be victory for one side and defeat for the other. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such base arts. Okay, so making your life doing political predictions. Yeah.
Except for that last one. One side will win and one side will lose.
Right.
That's pretty basic.
Yeah. Well, actually, both sides lose.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, so don't make your living making political predictions like that. Okay. Whereas some ascetics and brahmas make their living by such base arts as predicting an eclipse of the moon. Oh, what about the scientists? They're predicting eclipses of the moon. Is that a base art? I'm joking. Okay, predicting an eclipse of the moon, the sun, a star, that the sun and moon will go on their proper course, will go astray, that a star will go on its proper course or will go astray, that there will be a shower of meteors, a blaze in the sky, an earthquake, thunder, a rising, setting, darkening, brightening of the moon, the sun, the stars, and such will be the outcome of these things. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. Okay, so kind of doing astrology in some way. What's interesting is a lot of these things in modern day is what scientists do. But in ancient days, it was seen as a, you know, some kind of special art that you could see when, you know, I guess because of the mathematics, they didn't necessarily have the mathematics to do these predictions. Okay. Yeah, kind of nowadays, people want them to, you know, we want a prediction of an earthquake, don't we? Mm-hmm. So we can do this. So I think it could also be here that especially for monastics, this was a wrong means of livelihood because it took you away. Because for another thing, one example is, you know, monastics are not actually supposed to dig the earth or to cut any living plants or to do anything regarding agriculture. Does that mean that agriculture is non-virtuous in and of itself? No. Okay, it's not non-virtuous. It's just for monastics who are trying to steer their mind in a certain way. If you spend a lot of time doing that, then aside from the accidental killings that you could do of different animals and insects, then you could also, you know, spend all day working your field and have no time for your practice. Okay, so there are certain things that the Buddha curtailed for monastics that were not naturally negative, but for a monastic, because that person has shifted the direction of their life, then they're not to get involved in those things. Okay? Whereas some ascetics and Brahmas make their living by such base arts as predicting good or bad rainfall. Okay, a good or bad harvest, security, danger, disease, health, or accounting, computing, calculating, poetic composition, philosophizing. The ascetic Atama refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. So again, some of these things, it's not that they're negative in and of themselves, but it's just for a monastic who's trying to attain liberation and enlightenment and make their life beneficial in that way, then spending your time doing these things is not proper livelihood. Okay. Nowadays, of course, things have changed. So in a monastery, you have an accountant. Yeah, you have people who do computing. We have computers and all sorts of things. Yeah. I think in ancient times it was much easier. You know, you were a wandering ascetic. No telephone, no computer, no cell phone, no beeper. Yeah, you know, I mean, you just went off and did your thing and people had to wait to get in touch with you. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmas make their living by such base arts as arranging the giving and taking in marriage, engagements and divorces, declaring the time for saving and spending. Oh, there goes Alan Greenspan. Bringing good or bad luck, procuring abortions, using spells to bind the tongue, binding the jaw, making the hands jerk, causing deafness, getting answers with a mirror, a girl medium, a deva, worshipping the sun or great Brahma, breathing fire, invoking the goddess of luck, the ascetic Gotama refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. Okay? So, again, you could see that, you know, somebody who could do all this kind of, well, some of it wasn't magic, you know, arranging marriages and engagements and divorces, you know, and when to save and when to spend. Some of it is kind of magical things. And you can see that if a person's mind got really into that, that they might forget about the law of karma. Yeah, because what I find interesting is we call magic the things that put it this way, everything is a dependent arising. So everything actually, you know, all the functioning things, they all depend on causes and conditions. When we don't know the particular causes and conditions that cause something, then we call it magic. But as soon as we say magic, we think, oh, something that happens without causes and conditions, don't we? Yeah? So if we think of magic as something that happens without causes and conditions, and then you spend a lot of time doing magic, then it would be very easy to disparage the law of karma and its effects, and then think, you know, I can do anything I want ethically because there's, you know, there's no concordant relationship between the cause and the result. Yeah, so that could be quite dangerous for somebody. Okay, whereas some ascetics and brahmas feeding on the food of the faithful make their living by such base arts, such as wrong means of livelihood, as appeasing the devas and redeeming vows to them, making earth house spells, causing virility or impotence. Oh, poor Viagra manufacturers. Preparing and consecrating building sites. Uh-oh, we did that too. Giving ritual rinsings and bathings, making sacrifices, giving emetics, purges, expectorants, and phlemagogues. What's a phlemagogue? Maybe something to get rid of your phlegm? Okay. Giving eye, ear, nose medicine, ointments, and counter ointments. I guess when the ointments gives you a bad side effect. You know, nothing new. You take medicine, you get a side effect. Eye surgery, podiatry, using balms to counter the side effects of previous remedies. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. Okay, so you might say, well, wait a minute, this is the practice of medicine. Why is the Buddha saying that that's wrong livelihood and a base art? You know, we all go to doctors. Is the Buddha saying that taking medicine is bad and you should be one of these people who just heals by faith? No, what he's saying here again is for monastics doing those kind of careers is not suitable. Yeah, he's not saying that the careers themselves are bad and nobody should do them. But as a monastic, when you direct your life for one purpose, then don't use it. Spend all your time for other things. In Tibetan society, though, like I remember one of the very well-respected Tibetan doctors in Dharamsala was a monk. And so, you know, there are certain monks who go and study medicine. They also have a school of astrology. Yeah. And all of this is Tibetan culture. Okay. And so I think it's really important for us to discriminate what's Tibetan culture and what's Buddhism. Yeah. Because otherwise we start doing all these other things and we get quite confused. Yeah.
Do you think that that's also partly because the only school system was the monastic school system? So if you had, you know, the brains and interest to become a doctor, you still needed, you know, previous education. You were only going to get it.
Yeah.
By ordaining,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point, that the education system was monastic. So if you were going to have to study the different medical texts or something. You know, except if you came from quite a noble family, then the only other way. You know what's quite interesting? I've always been surprised at, this is getting off the topic, is that many of the Tibetan lamas cannot, they can read very well, but they can't write very well. And Tibetan has, just doing the letters and stuff, you know, the calligraphy is not so good. And also they don't know how to spell things. And I learned, and this is especially true for the older lamas. I don't know how it is with the young ones. But what I found out is that in in Tibetan government circles, you know, in pre-1959 Tibet, they had a certain portion of the government was lay people and a certain portion of the government was monastics. And if you were a monastic and knew how to read, if you also knew how to write very well, then you would be recruited to work in the government to do all the writing, because a government needs a lot of people to do a lot of writing. So a lot of times in the monasteries, they deliberately didn't teach writing so that then those monks couldn't be recruited to have to spend their time working on the in the government, and instead they could spend their time learning the Dharma in the monastery. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it was a very big surprise to me to learn that. But it really answered my question, because I would see sometimes my teachers, when they were teaching me Tibetan, not being unsure of how something to spell, or, you know, that. So it really, it explained it to me. Yeah, so that kind of thing makes sense. And then the Buddha concludes, there are monastics, other matters, profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, excellent, beyond mere thought, subtle, to be experienced by the wise, which the Tathagata, having realized them by his own super knowledge, proclaims, and about which those who would truthfully praise the Tathagata would rightly speak. And what are these matters? Okay, so you can see here the context that the Buddha's speaking in, that you could spend a lot of time on all these other things, but if you do that, then you're going to miss out understanding other matters that are profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, excellent, subtle. Okay, and so here he's talking about the correct view, the meditation methods, how to tame the mind. Yeah. Because it's actually quite difficult in society to find people who can teach you how to tame your own mind. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult to find. There aren't a lot of people. There's a lot of people who can teach you, you know, about health, and people who can teach you about, you know, computer science, and, you know, lots of people can teach you lots of things, but very few who can actually teach you how to work with your own mind. And how to bring about peace in your own mind. So for here, in this particular sutra, then the Buddha goes into a whole section on the 62 kinds of wrong views. Okay? And so it's interesting, because when he starts to talk about, you know, there's more excellent, profound, subtle, blissful things, the first thing he talks about is 62 wrong views. Why? Why does he talk about that? We won't read through all 62. This is the one that talks about the eel wigglers. You've heard me talk about eel wigglers. Okay. But why does he start talking about all these kinds of wrong view when he just gave this thing about, you know, subtle, blissful, peaceful, excellent? Why? Well, because the first thing you need to actually start practicing the Dharma is to have the correct view. Yeah? Because if you practice the Dharma with the wrong view, then you're not going to get the same realizations as the Buddha got. You know, you might get realizations, but they might be realizations of other things. Okay? And so I think it's quite interesting, you know, in the Eightfold Noble Path, we might think, oh, the correct view, that should come at the end, because in the three principal aspects of the path, it comes at the end. But in that context, the correct view means the wisdom realizing emptiness. Here, what the Buddha's talking about in terms of correct view is the basic general worldview that you have. Of course, it includes the notion of selflessness, okay? But it's also understanding cause and effect and how they work in your life. And so when he talked about the wrong views, he was talking about, maybe I should give you a sample here. Okay, people who do very severe ascetic practices, thinking that that's going to tame their mind. People who gain samadhi and recall past existences, you know, and that they think that that's all there is to do, that's a spiritual realization. People, yeah, who spend their time in meditative samadhis that are focused on things that don't pertain to enlightenment. Yeah, which you can spend a lot of time doing. Okay. And then all sorts of other views, you know, about how the world came into existence, how the world's going to go out of existence, you know, whether your actions have an ethical dimension to them, in other words, they're going to produce a result, whether the results correspond with the causes or not, all sorts of things like this. And so you really see, and that's why that first sutra in here is called What the Teaching Is Not. You know, because the Buddha was really emphasizing that the importance, the beginning of your practice, of gaining the correct view and just the whole correct outlook of how to practice and the outlook within which all your other practice is going to happen. So, for example, if somebody has a belief in a creator God that is going to send you to heaven and hell, if that same person then tries to practice the Buddhist path to nirvana, they're not going to be able to, yeah? Because their philosophical view won't allow for them to have the kind of questioning that the teachings on emptiness require you to have, okay? And or if somebody has a very nihilistic view, I don't know about you, but I went through a period in my life where I was very nihilistic. You know, just do whatever you want, just don't get caught, and nothing has any meaning, and like that. Then if you have that kind of viewpoint, then it's going to be difficult to practice because you're not going to follow cause and effect. And you're going to think that our actions have no ethical dimension, so I can do whatever I want, you know. Like I said, just don't get caught. Yeah. And so if you do that, then how are you going to gain spiritual realizations? Okay. So I find it quite interesting that, you know, the whole thing about what is our worldview is quite an important thing. And I know for me at the beginning of my Dharma practice, I think looking back on it, this was one of the things that I was really looking for, was a worldview that would help me make sense of what I was seeing and experiencing around me. Because of what I was seeing and experiencing, it didn't make any sense from the point of view of the religions that I had access to as a kid. You know, nothing made any sense. Whereas when I encountered Buddhism, the worldview there started making sense to me. It certainly wasn't hallelujah, you know. It wasn't hallelujah, I'm a Buddhist, I believe in rebirth. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like that. It was through a long period of, you know, kind of reflection and examination. But I found that I think that's what really gave me a lot of stability, is that I had a worldview that I could use to understand what was happening around me. Instead of just going like, this place is nuts, you know. Okay, so that's as far as I'm going to go in that chapter. I'm going to go back tomorrow to the sutra, the fruits of the homeless life, because here the Buddha is going to start to talk about the actual monastic practice of how, you know, how you practice, and especially with refraining the sense doors and how to do that and what that means. Okay, so that's it for today, folks. Do you have any questions? Anything brief? Yeah.
How many things are in this discussion that for, I mean, the wrong mindfulness, like, they extend you to, in a way, to the extent any kind of job, like,
Exactly. Like not having a career, not having a job. Yeah. And the idea being, and that's one of the ideas why monastics are called left home people, because, you know, they've left everything that that requires to have a home, which includes a job. And that just gives you much more time for your practice.
I remember when I was in Italy, Bishop Pinto said something that a monastic is a person that has time for, you know, practice and so on, and has no time for blah, blah, blah. But a practitioner is a person that has time for blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, and that's the idea. Everybody has 24 hours. And it's our priorities. It's always our priorities. So when somebody says, I don't have time, but have you noticed in America, you know, that is the sacred thing that you cannot ever question. If somebody says, I'm sorry, I don't have time, or if they say, I'm sorry, I don't have money, you can never question that. But actually what it is it's priorities, isn't it? Because everybody has the same 24 hours. It's just what we choose, how we prioritize what we do with them.
Just now you mentioned about the no computing, no accounting, right?
Yeah.
So now in the present life we have those. So are we? We are not. What do you call? We're not breaking this morality.
No. No, I think if you're doing it within the context of offering service to the monastery, yeah, then you're not doing this. This is referring to having a career and spending your time just doing that. But when you're, you know, for people and getting paid and whatever. But if you're offering services to the monastery and you're doing it as a way of helping the monastery function, then, you know, that's fine. I mean, like right now, several of us are learning things that I never thought I'd have to learn about
concrete,
for example, or building permits, or, you know, all this kind of stuff. So one way you could say, oh, this is just wasting the time to have to learn even about, like when we bought the property, I didn't even know about loans. And how interest was compounded and more. I didn't know any of this stuff. Now somebody could say, well, that's just a waste of time. Don't learn any of that stuff. In which case, then the Abbey wouldn't exist. Okay?
Thank you for the
name. you know, but on the other hand, if you look and you say, okay, I'm doing something to offer service for a project that is being done that's going to benefit other living beings, then, you know, it has some meaning and, you know, you're doing it with a very different motivation than just earning your own living so that you can eat and get the things you want. Okay? Like there's one nun in Venerable Chongyan. Is that how you say her name? She from the Taiwan, the one that founded Sushi Foundation. You're familiar with her? Oh, it's this incredible nun. I actually met her when I was in Taiwan. She started out her practice. She was doing, she went and did retreat, and she made one prostration for every word in the Lotus Sutra. Yeah? And she was just in a little cabin doing this, and eventually the villagers saw light coming from her cabin, and they got very scared and thought she was, you know, some weird person or something. Anyway, one day she was in a hospital, and she saw somebody come in who was bleeding, and the hospital turned that person away. And so she just determined that is totally unacceptable. And so all the people who wanted to become her disciples, she made it a condition that they help and work to try and start hospitals and clinics. And so she built on the east coast of Taiwan this huge hospital, because the east coast is the poor coast, huge Buddhist hospital. You walk in the entryway, and there's a big mosaic of the Buddha tending to one of the sick monks. You know, it's a very famous story because there was one monk who was ill, and the other monks, you know, they were too busy doing something else and didn't tend to him. And when the Buddha saw him, he was covered in his own filth. And when he found out what was happening, he scolded the other monks. And he said, when somebody's sick, you've got to take care of them. And so the Buddha took care of him, you know, himself. And so this is what the mosaic is in the opening. And so it's a brand new modern hospital. And, you know, she just said, anybody who's going to be my disciple, they have to help to make this happen. And so they started with that hospital. I've heard they've built a second hospital. And the Suchi Foundation now is international. And they have chapters in the States, too. And whenever there's, like after the, the tsunami and different events and things like that, then they go and they help people. And in Taiwan, in her hospital, they have volunteers doing many things. There is a waiting list to be a volunteer in her hospital. Yeah. And I know many Singaporeans who use their vacation time to go to Taiwan to offer service in her hospital because people just admire so much what she's doing. Okay. So here she is, you know, building hospitals and making medicine available to people. But that's certainly wonderful, isn't it? And I don't think she's wasting her monastic career at all. I think she's showing an excellent example of bodhicitta in practical application. Okay? Okay, so we'll end and say hello and thank you to Bill. They're going out because the guy who poured the concrete is leaving. Okay.